From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review The Lion King, the CGI version starring the voices of Donald Glover, Beyoncé, and Chiwetel Ejiofor. Jon Favreau directs. The documentary David Crosby, Remember My Name, tells the story of the singer-songwriter. Many more movies, our critics will tell us all about them. It's Film Week on KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Of course, the music from The Lion King, big release this week. We're also going to hear about a wide range of other films from our critics, Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Peter Rayner, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor, and Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. While we begin with Disney's The Lion King, a remake of the 1994 animated classic, directed by Jon Favreau, large ensemble cast, headed by Donald Glover, Chiwetel Ejiofor, James Earl Jones, and Seth Rogen.
Oh no, it's a little lion!
That is not a lion.
Well then go check it out, what is
it? That is not a lion, it's a furry bird!
It looks like a lion!
Yeah, that's not a lion, let me get a closer look, excuse me.
Alright, let me see what we're dealing with here. It's a lion! Run for your life,
Pumba! Wait, Timon!
The Lion King, rated PG, Charles?
The original Lion King is kind of the apex of the Disney renaissance of the late 80s and early 90s. It set a box office record that stood for a decade. It was a phenomenally popular and some amazing animation in it. Favreau has remade the film sort of in a photorealistic style, and as a result, it looks like a nature documentary someone's tried to stick a soundtrack onto. A real lion's face doesn't have the muscles to create expressions. It can't move its eyes. It can't wrinkle its forehead. It doesn't have the mouth shapes to do dialogue. So the character animation is completely lost. When Rafiki, who creepy looking, like a real mandrill, comes up to lift young Simba to the masses of animals, James Baxter moved this silly-looking character with great dignity, and so there was that interesting contrast in his movements, and his expression suggested wisdom and the affection between himself and Mufasa, and the pride in the new king, and this photorealism simply can't communicate that. It's not even the uncanny valley, it's like an uncanny gorge. You have these very real animals staring at you. They generally move well, but they aren't really telling the story. There's just no acting, and I don't understand it.
Amy, what do you think of The Lion King?
Yeah, Charles is exactly right. You know, original 2D animation, the way they did it, it's expressive, it's emotive, it's impressionistic. You can create all these emotions with it. This film felt kind of like Animal Planet mumblecore. There's nothing happening in here. I mean, and I get it. You're an animator.
That's a great line.
You spent all this time making this photorealistic lion, and oh, it's beautiful, and it looks exactly like a lion. And then, yeah, you don't really want to make it do anything unnatural, like sing or accuse its uncle of murdering its father. And you're just watching these lions sort of walk along with almost, it just sounds like you could have said dialogue over them, like just sort of recited lines as they're walking. And also, you make this, even the background is so cluttered with real leaves and real rocks that it becomes kind of hard to see the actual animals. At one point, they do a scene that's in a real cave, and because it's a real cave, there's real shadows on their face, and you can't see anything. It's really a bizarre movie. I mean, doing it this way, it's not just redundant, it's self-destructive. And I do have to add, though, being of the Lion King generation, the original one, I always thought Simba, he's such a whiny drip. And this film really is an argument against monarchy.
And is this a line-for-line, song-for-song remake?
Not quite. It's talkier. There are more bodily function jokes. And some of the songs are either trimmed back or rewritten. But some parts of it, particularly the opening, are almost shot for shot.
What'd you think, Peter?
I didn't mind this movie, you know, in the way that you guys did, but I also don't see its reason for being. I don't know why we need a third iteration of this story. Let's not forget, you know, the Julie Taymor-directed Broadway show, which was quite extraordinary and did a lot of interesting things, you know, on the stage with costuming.
And I was going to just interrupt for a moment. I mean, that was an example of taking it and doing it in a totally different way and connecting emotionally using a different technology.
Yeah, I mean, here they're doing it. Here they're doing it. I think, you know, it just reeks of, you know, let's do it again. Let's do a, you know, commercialism. If I were a Disney stockholder, I might have a different opinion of why they did this. But I just think there's no reason for this to be because what you're looking at is a sort of, you know, photorealist paraphrasing of far superior incarnations in the stage show and the original animation. You know, it's part of Disney's juggernaut to redo all of their animated movies in some other way. When I first heard about this movie, I stupidly thought, so James Earl Jones is going to dress up as a lion, Beyonce. I mean, I didn't understand what they were doing, you know, and I'm still not quite sure.
Well, are they going to put a real mouse in red pants and remake the band concert and Steamboat Willie?
They may.
Actually, that I would see.
The Lion King, directed by Jon Favreau. It's rated PG in wide release. The documentary David Crosby, Remember My Names, directed by A.J. Eaton, and it features extended interviews with Crosby about his experiences as a member of the legendary folk rock group Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
That's the house our house was written about, right there.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard.
Right. See that interior light there, the yellowy white one, back through that window, that's the kitchen. That's where Crosby, Stills, and Nash was born, right under that light.
And of course, you had a fourth member of the group as well, Neil Young, who would also join at times. Peter, please start us on this. Does it capture Crosby?
I would think so. I mean, never having met him, but I do think that it, you know, this is a sort of tell-all documentary where the subject is the one who's telling all. I mean, he lays it all out. He essentially says, I led a really dissolute life. You know, I'm 77. I've alienated everyone I've ever worked with. He says none of the musicians I've worked with in my career will talk to me. That includes Stills, Nash, Young, Roger McGuinn, you know, just everybody, a daughter of his. You know, the only thing is, I'm guessing that if that's truly the case, this documentary in a way is perhaps his way of trying to reach out to those people and say, you know, could we please reconnect? I mean, there is a sort of imploring aspect to what he says in this movie. He takes on full responsibility for having, you know, addicted virtually everyone he's ever had any contact with, including his adoring wife who's in the film. You know, but I also think it does explode several myths. There was an interesting documentary we talked about a while back called Echo in the Canyon.
Yeah,
about the, you know, the folk rock scene in Laurel Canyon. And Crosby was interviewed extensively in that movie by Jacob Dylan. Here the interviewer is Cameron Crowe, who produced the film, who knew Crosby since Crowe was a teenager writing for Rolling Stone. He's sort of the basis for the kid in the Almost Famous movie. So they have a very tight relationship, and that probably explains why Crosby is so open with him, you know, and also because I think he just wants to let it all out. He's in very bad shape physically, although he's had a creative renaissance in the last number of years. But again, he says in the movie, you know, I don't know how much more time I have. And so, in effect, he's using this movie as a way to reconnect with those people in his past who he feels he's alienated.
One of the things, you know, we've talked a lot about over the many years on Film Week, Peter, is, you know, do narrative films get the creative process right? So here you have a documentary, highly creative person to talk about. And is he able to articulate how he does what he does?
To some extent, I you know, he's not one of these artists who says, I have no idea where it comes from. You know, he does talk about sort of musicological aspects of what he does that would appeal to, you know, people who really know the music, chord changes and things like that. But mostly I think he talks about the psychological dynamics of you know, how these various groups came to be. He started out with the Byrds, then Crosby, Stills, Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. He and Graham Nash on Crosby, Stills and Nash had such perfectly complementary voices. I mean, it was like Simon and Garfunkel, you know, and again, this is mentioned in the movie. It was absolutely extraordinary sound. And, you know, when these groups break up, that's it. You can reproduce the songs with other groups, but you're not going to get that sound, which is one of the big problems I had with the movie yesterday and the Beatles.
We're talking about David Crosby, Remember My Name, from documentarian A.J. Eaton. What do you think, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, to Peter's point, there's a moment in the film where he's asked if he had to choose between having a life filled with music or having a life filled with love and a happy family, which would he pick? And he picks music. So you get that psychological pull he has to create more than I think you get the actual nuts and bolts of creation. But I found this film really, really striking for so many of the same reasons. It felt kind of not like a swan song, because he is still writing music, he's still performing, but his way of trying to make something that other people will hear, to really hear how sorry he is, or at least how much he is aware of the problems he caused in his relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a man who has 8 stents in his heart, who's still on the road, who's still creating. I mean, the sense I had watching this film, as he's going through all the sins he's done, all his ex-relationships, it kind of felt like he's sitting down and having a beer with the devil and being like, do I belong here? Let's have an honest conversation about it. And there's something really moving in that. I was glad that this wasn't just a hagiography, as I think we've had so many of recently.
Yeah, I also think it you know, it's fascinating when he talks about his he was very involved with Joni Mitchell for a time. I didn't know that. And so his insights into what Joni Mitchell was like and her creative process, you know, he thinks she's the absolute best, you know, was wonderful. And they have a lot of archival footage and photos and so forth. And just as a sidelight to movie fans, some may not know that his father was Floyd Crosby, who was one of the first Oscar-winning cinematographers. He shot High Noon.
Wow.
He shot the Orson Welles documentary on Rio, It's All True. And, of course, he shot all those great Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe movies.
David Crosby, Remember My Name, is at the Landmark in West L.A., the Arclight in Hollywood. It's rated R. John Horn on the frame interviewed A.J. Eaton, the director and producer Cameron Crowe, at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. That's where the doc premiered. And you can, on our Film Week page, hit the link to listen to that conversation. The documentary The Great Hack looks at the Cambridge Analytica scandal, examined through several affected individuals. The film is directed by Kareem Amir. Amy?
Yeah, this documentary starts off a little bit softball. You're thinking like, oh, okay, this is just another primer on the power of the internet. The narrator who kicks it off, who's a professor in, you know, social media and in intelligence on the internet, he's a little bit like, oh, pay attention to me. And I was turned off by this documentary a bit at the very beginning. And then as it gets into the story of Cambridge Analytica, which is really at the heart of this film, Cambridge Analytica being the UK firm that is credited with not only influencing the American election on Facebook, but also influencing Brexit, influencing a million elections around the world, Trinidad and Tobago. When they get into what they did in that election, it's really chilling. And it talks about their process, how they did it. And that's all actually incredibly interesting. But where the film really gets going is it introduces us to a character at the center of this whole story who I've been completely unaware of. And her name is Brittany Kaiser. She's a young girl. She's a girl who actually used to help with Obama's social media team. She was a political activist. She was very engaged. She meets Alexander Nix, the head of Cambridge Analytica, at a party, and he brings her on to the dark side. And when you meet her, she's this girl in like expensive clothing, who seemingly has no conscience at all. And this movie follows her as she decides, should I testify about this? And you can't even tell if she's one of the good guys or not, but she's a person who holds all this information. And she's really compelling.
What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, it's a scary movie because, I mean, it really does show you the extent to which data can be weaponized. You know, this whole data mining universe, which is really, you know, sort of taken over so much of how we live our lives, not to mention the elections that Amy mentioned. And Brittany Kaiser and also Professor David Carroll, who sued Cambridge Analytica to get the information that they were after on him. And there's a lot of interesting characters in this movie.
We'll continue our conversation about The Great Hack. Charles has seen it as well. Documentary that's just out this week. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back. Our reviews continue in 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with our critics, Peter Rayner, Charles Solomon, Amy Nicholson. We're talking about a documentary, The Great Hack, about the Cambridge Analytica election scandal. The film is streaming on Netflix, and it's also at Lemley's Monica Film Center. Charles, what do you think of The Great Hack?
I'm a little less high on it than my colleagues. I was surprised at how liberally the first 10 minutes borrow from Hosoda's Summer Wars in terms of its visuals. And I think the story is more interesting and more important than the film, that there's a lot. This has been reported to a great extent in a number of journals that I've been reading, online, following your rabbit hole, Larry. So I wasn't finding out that much new, that the faces and the voices were new, but the information it's more about other people's research, I think, than the research the filmmakers themselves did. They got people to talk, but I don't know how much is really the things that other people discovered first.
Peter?
Yeah, one thing is the film makes a case for how these organizations can overturn elections and change results and so forth. As reprehensible as I think the Russian infiltration into the most recent presidential election was, or Trump's denial of that, I think the movie pushes a little bit too much in the area of things would have been different had this not happened. There's no one comes out and says, well, but Hillary didn't campaign in these states and people really felt that there was a need for a change. And, not everyone's plugged into social media and not everyone takes their cue from social media who read it. So I think it's a little more complicated than just, press a button and win an election.
Yeah. Although to Charles's point that there's nothing super new in here, I would say one of the moments that I found the most fascinating is they're there in the room with this woman, Brittany Kaiser, when she's watching Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg testify in front of Congress. And there is kind of a thrill in watching her yell at the screen, that's a lie, that's a lie, that's a lie, that's a lie. I loved that.
The Great Hack is, again, on Netflix, Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. It's unrated. The comedic drama Sword of Trust stars Mark Maron, Gillian Bell, Michaela Watkins. Lynn Shelton is the director and co-screenwriter. Peter?
I really like this movie, aside from its really bland title. It's a low key comedy, seemingly improvisational, though I gather that there was a full script that was written for it. It's set in Birmingham, Alabama, in a pawn shop. And, these two women, a couple, one of them, the grandfather has died and left her a Civil War sword, a Union Civil War sword that in his demented state, writing a last letter to her would appear to be proof that the South actually won the Civil War and not the Union, and that there's been a vast cover-up. And there's this, for all I know, this may be true, that there's a sort of underground network of people who look for these artifacts called, prover items. And this sword is exhibit A for a whole bunch of wackos to try to, buy it and demonstrate that the South actually won the war and that everything else has been fake news. So that's the premise for the movie. Mark Maron, who's a wonderful comic and has a podcast and has been in a number of the films of Lynn Shelton, and also Joe Swanberg, who's another filmmaker who does these kinds of films, is the the proprietor of the pawn shop, a wonderful actor, very loose and he's just a funny, funny guy, terrific. And all the acting in this movie is wonderful. The people who play the Prover people, Toby Huss and Dan Bachendahl, who plays the boss, and the two women, Jillian Bell and Michaela Watkins. I mean, they all really mesh in a way that like a really good ensemble company. It goes a little bit off the rails at the end. There's a terrific scene where they're all on the way to the boss's place to sell the sword, and they're in the back of a van, and the Marc Maron pawn shop proprietor lets on about his druggy past, and suddenly the film gains an extra dimension. You really find out about this guy. It's not just a comic riff. And so, there's more to this movie than just jokiness, but there's a lot of fun in it, too.
Sword of Trust. Amy?
I didn't love this film as much as Peter, but that's because I really have been such a fan of the works of Lynn Shelton before. You know, movies like Hump Day, Laggies, that I felt like were really driving at some sort of big emotional point. And this one is a hangout movie, and you like to hang out with these people. I really enjoyed hanging out with these people. But in the scene that Peter's talking about, I just felt like, oh, now we're going to pretend this film is serious. This film is not serious. You know, the premise that it has is really interesting. You know, can you upend history by revealing the sword that everybody is considering priceless? And I kept waiting for the film to get into that. Like, what would that mean? In a way, I mean, a plot like that, it parallels the nightmarish things that Tom Hanks goes through in The Da Vinci Code, you know? But they don't really seem to wrestle with what would we be contributing to history with the sword. It's more like,
first of all, I think there probably are people who think that the South won the Civil War. I wouldn't be at all surprised.
There are people who don't get taught it properly who live in the South. I've definitely heard that.
Well, I mean, there's a very funny scene with the granddaughter of the grandfather of the sword and this other guy who works in the pawn shop who's trying to convince her that the earth is flat. And as these people are, you know, he comes up with these very detailed explanations.
Very logical argument.
Very logical argument, you know.
Were you convinced, Peter?
No, but I was
canceled that cruise.
I'm not, you know, I mean, it makes a lot of sense if you're nuts.
Stupid. Sword of Trust is the film. It's rated R at the New Art Theater in West L.A. John Horn of The Frame interviewed Marc Maron, the star, Lynn Shelton, the director, just last week. We have a link on our Film Week page, kpcc.org. You can hear that interview. Rosie is an Irish drama starring Sarah Green and Mo Dunford. Patty Bretnak is the director, and Roddy Doyle wrote the screenplay. Peter?
This is a terrific movie. That should get more attention than it appears to be getting. The background is present-day Dublin. It takes place over 36 hours. There was a tremendous recession years ago in Dublin, and then in 2014 the economy picked up. But I guess there's no good rent control there. But what happened was that, you know, thousands of families in effect, evicted from their homes because the landlords sold the place for a lot of money and they had nowhere to go. And, you know, one of the things that takes some getting used to is that you can have a pretty good job, as does the husband in this film, and still be homeless because you have nowhere to go. So the film follows essentially the mother. In a marvelous, marvelous performance by an Irish stage actress, Sarah Green, and her four kids, trying to find places to live on an almost nightly basis. They're given a list by the state of hotels and so forth where they crash for a night, but they're always sort of on the run. The kids go to school during the day. The husband works, so he can't really help out. It's a kind of frantic, you know, forward motion movie that never really lets up. And there's some marvelous. The best scene in it is when the mother is talking to the school principal. Her, I think, 6-year-old girl is in school, and the principal's very sympathetic and basically knows what's going on, but she says, you know, the kids have been making fun of little Millie. They call her Smelly Millie. And Sarah Green practically breaks down because, you know, she says, I'm a good mother. I wash my kids. But you can see how this is tearing her up. It's a great scene and a terrific movie and one of the best female performances of the year. It's written by Roddy Doyle, I might add, who's a marvelous novelist who wrote the books and the movies based on The Commitments and The Van. And it's just a terrific screenplay.
That's just the kind of film that Film Week is designed to highlight, those that might be overlooked. It's showing only at Lemley's Monica Film Center, but you hear Peter's strong endorsement for the Irish drama Rosie. It's rated PG-13. Amy's going to tell us about the thriller from Argentina, Rojo, which is written and directed by Benjamin Neustadt. Amy?
Yeah, this is an Argentinian film that has kind of a glimmer of what we've been seeing in the best Greek films that have been coming to the States lately. You know, that deadpan, hyper-real, but actually it's slightly surreal, very logical type of film that really gets into morality and ethical questions. You should know a tiny bit about Argentinian history before you see this film, because it's set in the year 1975, which is the year right before the military coup that changed Argentinian history. And so it's about a lawyer, and you see him at the very beginning of the film introducing himself in this restaurant as a very principled man who's too above getting into a fight with this lowlife trying to start a fight with him over a table. And over the course of this year, you see his principles get tested as he tries to keep considering himself a moral man. This film starts with an act of shocking violence, and then you have to kind of watch along and know what's happening in history as these people write off the disappeared, think, oh, this person's son is probably just getting drunk somewhere, and making more and more excuses for this world that they're trying to cling to. Even as watching it, you know it's all about to be ripped out from under their feet. I thought it was really just sort of deadpan, very funny, even though you feel uncomfortable laughing. I think people who walk into this are going to enjoy it a lot. It's a surprise.
Rojo is the film from Argentina. It's unrated at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Back in March, our critics reviewed the documentary Apollo 11, but it's having a special one-day showing Saturday to mark the 50th anniversary of the first moonwalk. Let's just real quickly review it. Charles, just a couple sentences on Apollo 11.
I remember seeing it in May. I really liked it, using only footage from that era. They put together a documentary that actually is suspenseful. Even though we know they landed on the moon, you're not convinced they're going to.
Peter?
Well, actually, Stanley Kubrick filmed the whole thing. So it's,
okay, it really got to
no, it's a terrific movie. It's all the sort of found footage that they put together to make this movie that's never been seen before. It's the amazing grace of Apollo landing movies.
All right.
Yeah, and I think part of what makes it feel so beautiful now, and why I think it does have such a hook besides the anniversary, is you're watching America at a moment where, yes, they've edited out Vietnam and everything else, but you're watching all these Americans come together to do something great. You're watching all these people watch the rocket take off. And there's something beautiful and unifying in watching this vision of what we can be when we put our minds to it.
I just remember, you know, years ago, I came out of a moon documentary at Sundance, and Buzz Aldrin was part of the reception afterwards. And I'm standing outside with Buzz Aldrin, looking up at the night sky, looking up at the moon, and saying to myself, how does this guy feel looking up there and knowing that he set foot on it?
It's amazing. I mean, just amazing. The Apollo 11, the documentary, again, one day showing, re-release Saturday in select theaters, rated G. Quickly want to mention the semi-fictionalized documentary biopic of the artist David Hockney. A Bigger Splash was released in 1973. Peter, quick comment on it.
It's an interesting movie. It's a sort of for David Hockney completists. It's a dramatized documentary. He plays himself. A lot of his friends and cohorts and lovers wander through it. The color coordination is very much in the line with his paintings.
Hockney, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating movie. Since that time,
no,
it's become
it
sort of an LGBT classic.
It's kind of the Hockney Witch Project, that it's supposedly found footage that was obviously posed. They don't really tell you about Hockney's creative process. You have these people sitting around Twittering when they could have actually been talking
about
how
Twitter.
A Bigger Splash at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. And just briefly, Peter, you're hosting an ongoing film series at the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena called The Female Gaze, French Women Directors Shine a Light on Their World.
Yes, it's on successive Fridays. Chocolat is this Friday, and then we have the best one, I think, probably is the final one, Vagabond, the Agnès Varda film with Sandrine Bonaire. You know, we show them on the big screen, and the turnout's been very good for what we've had so far.
And you introduce each of the films.
I introduce each of the films, and there's also Things to Come with Isabelle Huppert, which is a week from this week, and it's in connection with a series of paintings that they have in the museum dealing with, you know, French women in the 18th century in costumes and so forth. And it's, they always try to pair film series with exhibits in the museum. So that's the pretext.
Sounds great. We have a link on the Film Week page, kpcc.org, with the schedule of all the films at the Norton Simon Museum. We'll be back right after this. Great to have you with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you join us for our next Film Week screening, the entire series devoted to movies set in Los Angeles. Next up on Saturday night, July 27th, Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, the critically acclaimed film from 1997. What an all-star ensemble cast. Mark Wahlberg, Julianne Moore, Burt Reynolds, John C. Reilly, William H. Macy, Don Cheadle, Heather Graham, and that's just a start. Tickets available at kpcc.org/in-person. It's at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Saturday night, July 27th at 7 p.m. Well, Disney's acquisition of Fox, Warner's and Disney's launching their streaming services, the rise of Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Hulu. Movies are a dramatically changing business. And our guest is perfectly positioned to talk about a business that's changed during his decades at Columbia, Goldwyn, Fox, and Sony. Tom Rothman is the chairman of Sony Pictures Motion Picture Group, and next week the company releases Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Tom, welcome to Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. Very great to be here.
So after all the Weinstein Company's tumult and everything, Tarantino's next home was up in the air. What was the pitch you made to him for this film?
Lucky for us. Well, the pitch we made to him was really that movies and movie theaters still matter, and that we at Sony are very, very committed to the theatrical experience and the big screen experience. And from what we knew about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, we knew it was big cinema made for the big screen.
Now, when you made the pitch, had you seen his script, or did you make the pitch sight unseen?
No, I'm one of the very lucky, privileged few. I was shown into a closed conference room at the William Morris Endeavor, and locked in the room with just me and the script, and I read it and fell madly in love.
You said you're in love with the theatrical experience, believe in it. But we've had a summer where, aside from, you know, some superhero movies, the so-called tentpoles, it's been a very rough summer. And there are those speculating that the streaming services have done permanent damage to the film exhibition business. What do you think?
I don't think so. I think that, yes, it's true. It's been a summer of sequels and superheroes, and we at Sony have profited by that. We just had Spider-Man, which is hopefully on its way to $1 billion, and audiences love that. But I think it is a matter of the old Field of Dreams line. If you build it, they will come. There just hasn't been an original film this summer. And I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has a chance to be originality's last stand, you might say, in the summer, and to show that there is, adults will go to the movies in the movie theater in the summer if you program for them. If there's nothing for them to see, they can't, and they won't. But if there is, if you make a new original film and you push it and you take that risk, I think we believe that they will come.
So how do you market this movie in a way that communicates you need to see it on a big screen with other people? Don't wait for it to stream or be on demand at home.
Well, luckily, in this case, this is easier than most. You have a very rare, rare moment with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. For those of us, and Larry, I know you're a film fan like myself. We were of the Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid generation.
Great 70s film.
Exactly. And in those days, two big star pairing together, that actually happened. Newman and Redford made several films together. In the modern movie business, with our modern economics, it's much, much rarer and much harder. This film, Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio, two of the biggest male stars in the world together, plus not to mention Margot Robbie and a host of other wonderful, wonderful actors. So the pairing of two major, major stars in one movie is very eventizing. It's very unusual. It takes Quentin Tarantino and a director of that singularity and that level of vision to get those guys to do it. But when they're all in it, it's a special moment for the audience, and that gives it theatricality. That makes it worth, as I said to recently, yeah, you want to see Leo and Brad? Get a babysitter.
Well, but, you know, it's thought today that stars, even as big as the two stars in that film, don't sell tickets in the way that they used to.
I don't believe that. I very, very much don't believe that. I read that. I know it. But I think it's not true. Ask me a week from Monday. Maybe I'll think differently. But I think that's not true. I think stars in roles that the audience want to see them in, I would argue the opposite, Larry. I think they're more valuable than ever. We were at Cannes with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and the palpable excitement with Brad and Leo on the red carpet and that screening. I mean, the audience went crazy for it. I think the reality is that we just don't have enough of stars creating new signature roles, and that's what Quentin was trying to do.
We're talking with Tom Rothman, the chairman of Sony Pictures, talking about the film industry generally, also their big release next week, Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You sometimes get out of the blue huge hits. I mean, Jumanji. I mean, I knew you had hopes.
No, I did. I had hopes,
but not $1 billion.
No.
Nearly $1 billion.
Well,
so
Larry,
what,
can I get lucky every once in a while? Isn't that allowed?
But what do you attribute that film going off the charts in response?
I actually do. I actually can give you an answer to that. It's not. There's a lot of talk. You know, you're an expert in this. You hear all about IP and you know, known properties and pre-awareness properties. That really wasn't what made Jumanji a hit. What made Jumanji a hit was it had a great idea in it. It had a great universally relatable idea of the kids who became the avatars of adult selves. And you take the skinny little, you know, 90-pound weakling and he becomes The Rock. Right. And you take the big, tough football player and he becomes Kevin Hart. And you take the, you know, the mean girl prom queen. And who does she become? Jack Black. It just was a brilliant wish fulfillment idea. And that's really what did it. Great casting, great execution by Jed Kasdan and our Dwayne Johnson was also a producer on that. I know it because as we've worked on the sequel, which is coming at Christmas, the sequel to Jumanji, we had to strive very hard, and I think we've done it, time will tell, to come up with an equally big idea, an equally fresh new idea. So for all the talk about IP and sequels and superheroes, you can't forget the importance and the power of the idea at the heart of a film.
Tom, when you've got sort of lower budgeted films like Call Me By Your Name, something like that, you're not talking about high risk. You can go a distinctly artistic route. But Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, I mean, that seemed kind of risky, right? It's the type of animation, the storyline, the budget of that compared to a typical art house film. So what made you decide to take that risk?
Well, I can tell you, it's a core belief of mine after 30 plus years. And it's why I listen to Film Week, is that really great directors and great talents will make great films. And we had in Chris Miller and Phil Lord two extraordinary, extraordinary talents behind that film. And there were a number of also Bob Persichetti and a number of really talented directors who worked on it as well. And my colleague Christine Belson and runs Sony Pictures Animation. But there were real talents behind it. But you're absolutely right. It was
even
a risk.
With that, it's a big
risk.
Yeah,
of course. I was scared to death. But you know what, Larry? I think in this job, if you're not scared, if you're not pushing the boundaries, if you're not trying, I don't think you're doing your job, and you can't eliminate risk in the movie business. We also felt it was very important. You know, that's a story with a diverse mixed race lead, a much broader, more inclusive look at the Spider-Man universe, and we felt that was very important.
And you captured lightning in a bottle with that. A terrific film. It was a hit as well as critically acclaimed and the best animated feature, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We have much more to talk about with Tom Rothman, the chairman of Sony Motion Pictures, a very competitive landscape in the film business today with all the different players. We'll talk more with him about that as we continue on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk and Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with the chairman of Sony Pictures, Tom Rothman, joining us. We're talking about the precarious state of theatrical film exhibition. But Tom thinks there is a very bright future. And one of the things I saw a quote of yours was that when you're looking at younger moviegoers, they don't go to the movies anymore.
No, I said that, and I stick by it. They don't go to the movies the way you and I did, Larry. They go to a movie. By which I mean that you have to achieve a level of cultural urgency for them. It's not an ingrained habit, but they will go if it becomes really culturally relevant to them, relevant in their lives. Then they'll go in big numbers, very big numbers. But you just can't count on it. They don't go hang out at the movies and pick any old movie on a Friday night. So that just raises the bar for us. You know, there we can see already in the interest in Quentin's movie coming out how their young moviegoers are still an avid audience, but you've got to motivate them specifically.
I wanted to talk about the diversity of the film audience. We've seen a dramatic increase in the number of films with African-American leads, African-American themed issues that are serious for the African-American community. It seems like we're still lacking when it comes to Latino films. And it also seems to me that we're still lacking when it comes to films that show the sort of natural diversity as people go through their lives mixed together. And why do you think that is? Why is this not depicted on screen?
I have only theories. I don't know. I know in particular at Sony we tried this year, particularly with a film with Gina Rodriguez called Miss Bala, where we really were working hard. That was an empowered Latina lead with a fully Latinx crew. 90%+ of the behind the scenes crew were Latinx on the picture. And I'll be honest, I had higher hopes and aspirations for it, but we're not going to quit. And I don't pursue it out of altruism or political correctness. I pursue it out of the reality of the audience, which is ours is a heterogeneous audience, and we have to program for that audience as a whole. I think the real issue, to tell you the truth, is that the business entirely has to do a better job of bringing more creators of color into the creation side, into the writing, the directing, and the producing side. And I think as we do that, then them telling stories which are relevant to their own experience, that will increase. I think we're making progress on the gender front, though. I'm happy to say about that.
Yeah, and you certainly see that. I mean, I think one of the appeals of the Fast and the Furious franchises isn't just the cars; it's the mix of the cast.
Yeah, there's no question. And you mentioned earlier, we talked a little bit about Spider-Verse, and that had a mixed black and Latino protagonist, a 14-year-old mixed race kid, and that brought in a much wider audience than would be typical for a superhero film. So I think, and that's absolutely true about the success of Fast and the Furious, and it's true about a number of films. So look, particularly the. Just look at 40% of the population of California, I believe. Hispanic. So we certainly need to continue to push.
You've worked, and particularly at the start of their careers, with a lot of directors. Just they were establishing themselves. I think Ang Lee, because you worked Wedding Banquet.
I did the Wedding Banquet.
Yeah,
Eat Drink Man Woman.
Yes. Exact. Jim Jarmusch, didn't you?
Yes, I produced
Down by Law.
I did. I produced Down by Law in my youth and childhood.
So you've been there at sort of, you know, the origins or early development. And what more can studios, streaming services do to nurture that talent?
Well, that's a really, really good question. And I think a really imperative question and an imperative that we on the production side and the financing side must ask ourselves. Because at a certain point, there are only so many sequels and superheroes that you can do in the world. And we have to bring new and particularly diverse voices in. So what it amounts to, Larry, is being willing to take risks. You have to be willing to gamble. I mean, yes, is it a risk to bring an original film like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood out in the middle of the summer or in the middle of all the sequels and the supers? Yes, it's a risk, but Quentin Tarantino is established. What we have to do is find the next Quentin Tarantino. You know, we're working this year with a fabulous female director. You're probably familiar with her work, a woman named Greta Gerwig, and she made Lady Bird. And now she stepped up. This will be her first studio film. It's a very postmodern look at Little Women. It's not like any Little Women before. And I know this very well because my wife is an actress and she once starred in the TV show of Little Women. So I know there have been a lot, but
yeah,
this
Jessica
one is
Harper,
brand new.
Yeah.
Yes. But Greta Gerwig, Mariel Heller, these are Liz Banks. These are new, strong female voices. And I think it's important for studios to take risks, to nurture them and provide them the opportunity.
Well, and you can see with some, like Greta Gerwig, the talent was obvious right out of the gate. I mean, you can see she's got the eye. And so when you see people that exhibit on a first feature that kind of ability,
you gotta back it. I mean, I have always often say about Greta, people ask me, I just say quite simply, she's the real deal. But look, you can. It's all John Watts, who's done a spectacular job for us reinventing the Tom Holland live action Spider-Man. You know, we hired him off a little feature called Cop Car. But if you looked at that film, you could tell there was a real directorial hand at work. And I suppose, you know, you mentioned going all the way back to some of the first films I was privileged to work on. When I had much fewer gray hairs, which fortunately your audience can't see because we're on radio. But, you know, whether it was Jim or Aang or I made Anthony Minghella's first films or Ken Branagh's first films, if you know what to look for, you know it when you see it. And the best thing that a studio can do, actually, is to nurture young talent and to take risks with young talent. You're going to fall. You're going to stumble, but everybody falls. Champions get
well,
back
and
up.
it's the nature of your business. Riding high in April, shot down in May. That's the
tell me
business.
About it, brother.
That's the. I mean, you had some tough times not that
yeah.
long ago.
Yeah, this May, for example,
and now you get a renewed contract after some great success. Just we're almost out of time,
sure.
But there's such a glut of product with everything out, with the streaming and everything. You concerned about too much and not enough gatekeeping and quality control?
Great question. Not for us. And you asked at the start of the interview about the theatrical experience. And that's what distinguishes the theatrical experience. I suppose if I was a streamer, I would worry about that. But there are only 52 weekends in the year. And what we do in the theatrical business is we make cultural impact. You may choose to go to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, or you may not, but you will know about it because it's culturally relevant. And that's what movies and movie theaters can do, and that's what streamers can't do.
Tom Rothman, great to have you with us on Film Week. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Larry.
He's the chairman of Sony Pictures Motion Picture Group, joining us to talk about the studio. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.